Welcome back to Ghosts of Arlington, and thank you for joining me for episode 75, The Space Shuttle, Part 1.
Yes, sir, reading you loud and clear. The clock has started.
Five, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Liftoff! We have a liftoff!
Last week, we talked about the joint U.S.-Soviet Apollo-Soyuz test project when the two rival superpowers, in a moment of easing tensions, came together for a shared space mission. When American astronaut Tom Stafford shook hands in space with Soviet cosmonaut Alexei Leonov, the space race officially ended. Many hoped this would mark the beginning of a new era of cooperation between the East and West, but it was not to be. At least not yet. And after the mission, the Cold War ramped up again. After Apollo-Soyuz in 1975, the Soviet Union sent up a new and improved Salyut space station capable of operating for extended periods of time. Salyut 6 spent 1,764 days in orbit between September 1977 and July 1982. During that nearly five-year mission, a total of 33 cosmonauts spent 683 days, more than a year and a half, aboard. The station's follow-up, Salyut 7, the final Salyut space station, spent a whopping 3,216 days in space between April 1982 and February 1991. During those 9 years, 22 cosmonauts spent 861 days, more than 2 years, aboard during a time when the Soviet Union was suffering economic hardship and nearing collapse. The final two stations combined the best of their predecessors, operating as civilian-military hybrids, conducting both scientific experiments and surveillance and reconnaissance. NASA, faced with falling budgets in the wake of Apollo, turned its attention to what it hoped would be more cost-effective methods of exploring space. The benefits of winged spacecraft had long been recognized, but such vehicles were sidelined in favor of the ballistic approach as the space race took hold. Now the idea was revived in NASA's Integrated Space Transport System, a space shuttle that would make routine trips to and from orbit, and a large space station that would be serviced by the new spacecraft. The basic idea of a winged, rocket-powered space station that can use aerodynamic lift to travel at least part of the way into space was first proposed in the 1930s by Eugene Sanger, a member of the German VIR Rocket Society. His concept involved a spacecraft launched at supersonic speeds on a rocket-powered sled. Other ideas often used some combination of a ballistic launch and a plane-like descent. The true ancestors of the space shuttle, however, were the hypersonic X-craft that could fly more than 5 times the speed of sound and were tested by NASA and its predecessor NACA through the 1950s and 60s. Now, I believe that this is the second time he has been mentioned in passing in the podcast, but the most famous person connected to the X-Craft program is probably Chuck Yeager, who became the first to break the sound barrier in a Bell X-1. I also believe that this is now the second time that I have mentioned that Yeager, himself a ghost of Arlington, will likely get his own episode at some point, but today is not that day. Several of the later model X-craft had stubby wings and relied on the shape of the fuselage itself to generate most of the aerodynamic lift, often referred to as a lifting body. Normally carried to high altitudes while attached to a larger aircraft, They fired their rocket engines on release, accelerating rapidly and following trajectories that looped up to 17 miles or 28 kilometers above the Earth before plummeting back in a hair-raising, unpowered supersonic glide. Although NASA did not pursue the lifting body concept at the time, it proved highly influential in the design of many of today's private post-shuttle spacecraft. Throughout the early decades of space exploration, there were no reusable launch vehicles, so each launch was extremely expensive. NASA's plans for the space shuttle, developed in the early 1970s under Administrator James Fletcher and announced by President Nixon on January 5, 1972, were supposed to dramatically cut the cost of reaching orbit and make routine spaceflight a reality. Coincidentally, the House of Representatives passed the budget for the shuttle program on April 21, 1972, while John Young and Charlie Duke were on the moon during the Apollo 16 mission. The duo got the word from fellow astronaut Tony England, who was working in mission control. He radioed up to his buddies and said, "This looks like a good time for some good news here. The House passed the space budget yesterday, 277-60, which includes the vote for the shuttle." Both Young and Duke shouted for joy. Young said, "Beautiful," and Duke said, "Wonderful." Then Duke said what a lot of folks at NASA were thinking. "The country needs that shuttle mighty bad. You'll see." And just where would this spaceship shuttle to? As I mentioned before, it was assumed that it would shuttle to a U.S. space station, which seemed to make a lot of sense. This would prepare us for flights to Mars, which was seen as the next logical step in space exploration. We would use the space station as a spacecraft assembly node and launch interplanetary expeditions from there. As Jack Luzma, a member of the second Skylab crew, put it, "We had all hoped that there would be a mission to Mars before the end of the century, but then the space station fell out of the plan because NASA couldn't afford both it and the shuttle." The space budget provided insufficient funds for both projects, so the station was soon abandoned to concentrate on the shuttle, which would now take on the role of orbiting laboratory as well as the launch vehicle. With budget and political backing secured, NASA invited concepts from contractors and was deluged with several different designs. The most popular early plan envisioned a two-stage vehicle, with the spaceship carried most of the way to orbit by a large rocket-powered piloted carrier aircraft similar to the X-15, one of the later X-craft. When this plan was dismissed as too expensive, NASA reluctantly recognized that not all of the systems could be completely reusable. The final version of the space transport system was a compromise born of necessity. The U.S. military's need for a sizable orbiter to launch its largest payloads, in other words, its spy satellites, made it impossible to design a fully reusable system. But the shuttle portion of the design was at least largely reusable. In addition to the shuttle orbiter, there are three other elements: a large external tank and two side-mounted solid rocket boosters. Each of these plays an important role in getting the shuttle into orbit. And now, thanks to NASA not copywriting a lot of what they put out, I will let NASA tell you a little more about getting the shuttle into space.
Millions of people watched the roaring engines and thundering rush of fire and twin pillars of smoke that make up the unique signature of a space shuttle launch. They saw four large machines work together precisely to send astronauts, satellites, observatories, and space station segments into orbit. The four elements, when combined ahead of launch, were called a shuttle stack. They included the shuttle itself, also known as the orbiter, plus a pair of solid rocket boosters and a single external fuel tank. The external tank, or ET, is the familiar orange structure that dominates most images of the shuttle at liftoff. At more than 15 stories tall, it is the largest single part of the shuttle stack. It gets its signature orange color from the foam insulation sprayed on the tank's aluminum structure. The insulation helps the tank act as a thermos bottle to keep the super cold propellants from evaporating too quickly. It also helps prevent ice from forming on the tank's exterior and promotes the right aerodynamic shape for launching into space. The main job of the tank is to hold about 535,000 gallons of super cold liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. The lower portion of the tank holds the liquid hydrogen, which is the fuel for the engines. The second coldest known chemical, it is stored in the tank at minus 423 degrees Fahrenheit. The upper part of the tank holds liquid oxygen, chilled to minus 297 degrees. During the space shuttle fleet's 30 years of operation, the tank, like the shuttle itself, has undergone numerous upgrades and weight-saving improvements. For example, designers quickly saved 600 pounds by not painting the tank white after the first two missions. Following a few revisions to designs and materials, the latest version of the tank, known as the Super Lightweight Tank, is 17,000 pounds lighter than the first one Columbia used in 1981. The twin solid rocket boosters, or SRBs, are bolted to either side of the tank, with the shuttle itself riding piggyback. This approach was revolutionary in rocket design when it debuted in 1981. Until then, rockets were built by stacking one stage on the top of another and then casting off the stages one at a time until a small spacecraft was left on its own in orbit. Until the space shuttle's first mission in 1981, no astronaut had ridden into orbit on the strength of solid-fueled rockets. The SRBs hold their own fuel, a mixture of powdered aluminum and a chemical called ammonium perchlorate. When dry, the combination feels like a pencil eraser. The fuel is the solid in the solid rocket booster's name. The 15-story tall boosters work much simpler than liquid fuel rockets that require complex engines and pumps. They produce nearly 7 million pounds of thrust. The solid rocket boosters do not ignite until the shuttle's main engines are up and running. At liftoff, flames shoot down through the inside of the booster to ignite the fuel. Once ignited, the boosters cannot be turned off. A pair of boosters combines to burn 9 tons of fuel every second. The boosters accelerate the 4.5 million pound shuttle stack to 3,000 miles per hour and 24 miles high in just 2 minutes. By then, most of the fuel is used up and the boosters fall away, leaving the shuttle's own main engines to reach orbit. The boosters parachute safely into the ocean, where they are recovered and reused on later launches. After the shuttle engines shut down and the orbiter is on its way, the external tank falls away and safely burns up in the atmosphere over the ocean.
Thanks, NASA. Now, for those of you who would like the last few measurements from the previous clip in the metric system, together the two solid rocket boosters burn more than 8,100 kilograms of fuel every second. The boosters accelerate the 2 million kilogram shuttle stack to 4,800 kilometers per hour and 40 kilometers high in just 2 minutes before most of the fuel is used up and the boosters parachute into the ocean to be gathered and reused. Before the launch, the stack is put together at Kennedy Space Center's Vehicle Assembly Building on top of the mobile launch platform. Then when the stack is ready to move to the launch pad, the mobile launch platform is placed atop an enormous mobile tractor unit called the Crawler Transporter, which then slowly moves the 8-ton or 7,200 kilogram stack to the pad at a top speed of 1 mile or 1.5 kilometers per hour. It takes 3.5 hours to move a shuttle to Launch Pad 39 Alpha, and 4 hours to get one to 39 Bravo. Although NASA was given the go-ahead to build the space shuttle in the early 1970s, a host of issues needed to be solved before construction work could begin and optimistic hopes of a first flight in 1977 were soon revised. One significant cause of delay was the question of military use. To provide the predicted savings in launch costs, the shuttle would have to fly regularly, somewhere in the neighborhood of one mission every 2 or so weeks. The demand for such frequent launches would only be there if the U.S. totally abandoned unmanned rocket launches, including those for military payloads. For this reason, the Air Force agreed to contribute to shuttle development costs, but only if the spacecraft was redesigned so it could carry the bigger military satellites. It would also have to be capable of launching from the Air Force's launch site, Vandenberg Air Force Base, near Santa Barbara, California. And the Air Force would need to be guaranteed a certain number of launches each year. With all these new requirements, work began on a shuttle prototype, originally called Constitution, in June 1974. The shuttle's complexity made it difficult to test all its elements separately. A dummy called Pathfinder was built to test some of its support systems. Multiple scale wind tunnel models were also created, and the prototype Constitution, now renamed Enterprise, was launched off the back of a Boeing 747 in a series of tests called approach and landing tests, or what I will call ALP flights going forward. Between February and October 1977, 16 ALT flights took place, divided into 3 phases. Before I get into these ALT flights, I have a quick word about the prototype's name change. As I said, it was going to be called Constitution, and this was because it would be completed in 1976, during the bicentennial celebration of the U.S. Constitution. However, a letter-writing campaign by Star Trek fans persuaded President Gerald Ford to change the name to Enterprise after the ship the crew on Star Trek uses to explore the cosmos. The nerds got their way. And I say that with all love, I'm a Trekkie myself. And when the prototype was unveiled to the public on September 17, 1976, not only was it named Enterprise, but Star Trek creator Gene Roddenberry and several members of the Star Trek cast were in attendance. Check out the website. I've posted pictures of the actors in amazing 1970s leisure suits. 2 crews were assigned to carry out the ALT flights. The first crew consisted of Apollo 13 veteran Fred Hayes as the commander and Gordon Fullerton, a member of NASA's 7th group of astronauts, as the pilot. And of course, when I use the term pilot with the astronaut corps, it almost always means co-pilot, as the mission commander usually sat in the pilot seat and flew the spacecraft. When the initial shuttle flight schedule came out, Hayes was tapped to command the second shuttle mission, but delays in the program led to his retirement before the shuttle was ready. Fullerton would go on to command the 3rd shuttle mission. The 2nd crew was commanded by Joe Engel, a veteran of the shuttle predecessor X-Craft program and a member of NASA's 5th group of astronauts. He was joined by pilot Richard Truly, who, like Gordon Fullerton of the 1st crew, came from NASA's 7th class of astronauts. Engel would eventually replace Hayes as the commander of the 2nd shuttle mission and also commanded the 20th mission, while Truly would join the crew of the 2nd mission, command the 8th, and eventually become NASA's 8th administrator. All ALT flights originated from Edwards Air Force Base in California's Mojave Desert. The first phase of the program was designed as the taxi test, where the Enterprise was mated atop a Boeing 747 airplane to verify that the plane could taxi without problems with the shuttle mounted on top. The 3 taxi tests, all conducted the same day, did not actively involve Enterprise, so it remained powered down and uncrewed, but this allowed the program to move into the next phase, captive flights. The first captive flights were inert flights just to test the flight and handling characteristics of the 747 while again it was playing piggyback with the 150,000-pound or 68,000-kilogram orbiter. As with the taxi tests during these inert flights, the shuttle was powered down and uncrewed. The first time the alt-flight tests involved crew members in a powered-up shuttle were the three active captive flights, which were intended to determine the best profile for both Enterprise and the 747 when the orbiter finally separated from the airplane. These three active tests also refined shuttle crew procedures and ensured the shuttle was ready for the final phase of testing, free flight operations. Five free flights were flown where Enterprise was carried by the 747 to altitudes between 15,000 and 30,000 feet, or 4,500 and 900 meters, and released, allowing the orbiter to glide from altitude and land. These flights tested the flight characteristics of the shuttle itself on a typical approach and landing from orbit. Air data probes were used to collect information about these flights and gave astronauts preparing to pilot shuttle missions an idea of what landing the spaceship would be like. These five flights were the only time Enterprise flew alone. Following the alt-flight program, Enterprise was taken to Huntsville, Alabama, for vertical ground vibration tests with an external fuel tank and rockets mounted, and then on to Kennedy Space Center in Florida to test the procedures of assembling the stack in the vertical assembly building, transporting it to the launch pad, and then making sure everything fit properly at the pad. As the shuttle program got underway, Enterprise was put into storage from 1985 to 2003 before it was restored and put on display at the newly constructed Smithsonian Air and Space Museum's Udvar-Hazy Center Annex, open near Dulles International Airport in Virginia, where it served as the centerpiece of that museum's space gallery until, well, that's a story for another day, so for now, we're just going to leave Enterprise at the Udvar-Hazy Center and get back to the preparation for the shuttle program's first spaceflight. While NASA was building and testing the space shuttle, it was also recruiting its first new astronaut class in nearly 10 years and ushering in the era of equal opportunity at the space agency. The Equal Employment Opportunity Act of 1972 gave teeth to the Civil Rights Act of 1964 to address employment discrimination against women and many minority groups in U.S. society. Supporters of the legislation hope that it would spur social change, but societies are not so easily changed. Women in science and engineering still found the culture off-putting, and while colleges dramatically increased their enrollment of women in these fields, many women found themselves in classrooms mostly filled with men, some of whom were openly hostile to their presence. Although women in the early 1970s received nearly 40% of the PhDs awarded in biology, they represented just 4% of those in engineering, and wouldn't crack 10% until the 1990s, the same time that African Americans rose to 2% of doctorates in all STEM fields. In 1971, NASA Administrator James Fletcher appointed African-American Ruth Bates Harris as the administration's first Equal Employment Opportunity Director. And while this was a step in the right direction, she was demoted to one of three Equal Opportunity Deputy Directors before starting her new position, and was relegated to working only with contractors. And Dudley McConnell, NASA's most senior African-American engineer, was made deputy in her stead. Despite her reduced role, Harris proved to be a feisty and forceful presence who was not afraid to ask uncomfortable questions. After reading a newspaper report that Wernher von Braun had used slave labor to build his rockets for the Nazis in World War II, she directly questioned him about it. Additionally, in late 1973, Harris and her two fellow deputies, former Tuskegee Airman Samuel Lynn and Joseph Hogan, prepared a report on the state of equal opportunity at NASA on their own time and submitted it directly to Fletcher. The report concluded, "NASA has demonstrated to the world that it has limitless imagination, vision, capability, courage, and faith, limitless persistence, and infinite space potential. It made the United States a winner in space and improved the quality of life for all people. However, in spite of sincere efforts on the part of some NASA management and employees, human rights in NASA have not even gotten off the ground. In fact, equal opportunity is a sham at NASA." After receiving the report, Fletcher fired Harris, transferred Hogan, and reprimanded Lynn. To the administrator's surprise, Harris's firing generated a storm of negative media coverage. 70 NASA employees protested the decision, and NAACP Legal Defense Fund lawyers petitioned the United States Civil Service Commission to rule Harris's dismissal an unlawful reprisal. NASA's legal counsel advised Fletcher to settle. The U.S. Senate Committee on Appropriations demanded an explanation, and senior committee member Senator William Proxmire grilled McConnell. Aides urged Fletcher to appear before the Senate Committee on Aeronautical and Space Sciences, but he sent Deputy Administrator George Lowe in his place in January 1974. Fletcher hired another African American, Harriet Jenkins, to replace Harris as McConnell's deputy, and in August 1974, Harris was rehired, but in a new role in community outreach and public relations, and remained with NASA until 1976. Dudley McConnell resigned as Director of Equal Employment Opportunity before the end of 1974. Jenkins stepped into the position and served there until 1992, where great changes occurred under her watch. During her nearly 20 years at NASA, she was responsible for implementing several programs that assisted minorities and women. The most visible example were the astronauts selected during that time, but the program also extended to procurement contracts and research efforts. Mercury capsules had a single astronaut, Gemini capsules 2, and Apollo 3. The shuttle was designed to carry a crew of 5 to 7 people serving in 3 to 5 roles. First, a commander. The astronaut who would be responsible for flying the shuttle and for all aspects of the mission. Second, a pilot. The astronaut who would serve as the co-pilot and mission's deputy commander. Third, mission specialists. One or more astronauts who would perform other duties related to the operation of the orbiter. The number of mission specialists would be determined on a mission-by-mission basis. Fourth, a payload specialist, a non-astronaut with expertise in the spacecraft's payload. And finally, a passenger, a non-astronaut present as an uninvolved observer. Although the payload specialist and passenger would not be astronauts, they were expected to have undergone some astronaut training for safety purposes. An early decision said that mission specialists would not have to be pilots, which had been required of the scientist astronauts selected in NASA Astronaut Group 4 in 1965 and Astronaut Group 6 in 1967. A comprehensive pilot recruitment plan was drawn up in 1974 and another for mission specialists in 1975. But it wasn't until 1976 that provisions to allow the recruitment of women and minorities were included in those plans. The call for applications went out in July 1976 for at least 15 pilots and 15 mission specialists. Once selected, the training cycle was expected to take 2 years, and for the first time, new selectees would be considered astronaut candidates rather than full-fledged astronauts until they finished training. Pilot candidates had to have at least a bachelor's degree in engineering, a physical science, or mathematics, although an advanced degree was preferred, and at least 1,000 flight hours, though 2,000 were preferred. Preferred candidates were between 5 feet 4 inches and 6 feet 4 inches tall, or 162 and 188 centimeters. And they had to be able to pass NASA's rigorous Class 1 physical. For mission specialist candidates, the degree could also be in the biological sciences. No pilot experience was necessary. The minimum desired height was 5 feet or 152 centimeters tall, and they only had to pass a Class 2 physical. The main difference between the two physicals was that glasses were acceptable for the Class 2 physical as long as eyesight was 20/20 while wearing them. Applications were accepted for 1 year, and between July 1976 and June 1977, about 20,500 application packets were requested from NASA, with 8,079 applications returned, most in the final 2 weeks before the deadline. Of the applications received, 6,329 met the minimum requirements and were passed on for consideration. 649 qualified pilots applied. 128 were military and 512 were civilians. From those, 80 were selected for interviews, 76 military pilots and 4 civilian pilots. 3 of these were minorities of the 10 who had applied, but none of the 8 women who applied were interviewed. 5,680 qualified mission specialist applications were received. 161 were military, including 6 minorities and 3 women. Of the 5,519 civilian applications, 332 were from minorities and 1,248 from women. A selection board reduced this number to 128 before granting interviews. In the end, 35 astronaut candidates were hired and introduced to the public on February 1, 1978. NASA's largest astronaut cohort to date was ambiguously called the TFNGs. For public purposes, this stood for 35 new guys. However, within the group, it was known to stand for the military acronym, the FNG. And if you don't know what an FNG is, go ask a veteran, who I'm sure will laugh and happily tell you. Just make sure there are no young ears around when you do. Of the 73 astronauts who had been selected in NASA's 7 previous groups, only 27 were still active when Group 8 was announced, so right away the new guys outnumbered the veterans. At the introduction press conference, most of the attention was on the 6 women selected and, to a lesser extent, the 4 minority men, all of whom were selected as mission specialists. Breaking down Group 8 a little more, 15 were pilots and 20 were mission specialists. 20 were active duty military, and another 4 were prior service. 20 had served in combat. Of the 15 pilots, all were test pilots. 8 from the Navy, 6 from the Air Force, and 1 was a NASA test pilot. Of the 20 mission specialists, 4 came from the Air Force, and 1 each from the Navy, Marine Corps, and Army, making Bob Stewart the first Army officer to become an astronaut. 10 of the specialists had never served in the military, but one of them, Catherine Sullivan, later served in the Navy Reserve as an oceanographer from 1988 to 2006. Finally, 10 of the 35 had bachelor's degrees, 13 had master's degrees, and 12 had doctorates. And that, dear listener, is where we will leave our story this week. But next week we will continue with the launch of the first space shuttle mission. If you need more Ghosts of Arlington content in your life, there are pictures related to every episode on the website, www.ghostsofarlingtonpodcast.com. You can help others learn about the podcast by leaving a 5-star rating and review at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. If you really want to make my day, refer the show to a friend. And remember, fear not death, for the sooner we die, the longer we shall be immortal.